Good evening. Good afternoon. This is Katie Bosler here for Juno Afternoon. I am filling in as the host for a bit this summer, filling in for Scott Burton. It is just about 3 o'clock here on KTOO FM 104.3 in Juno. For the show today, David Bruce will be here to talk about this weekend's Amateur Radio Field Day. That's coming up on Saturday afternoon. We'll continue our Words 101 series with a conversation about publishing your own book with guest Flip Todd of Todd Communications in Anchorage. And we'll talk with Miles Gayton of the UAS Class of 2015 about his UAS journey to learning to speak fluent Spanish.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Marvin Roberts, one of four men fighting for exoneration from murder convictions in Alaska, has been paroled. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the Fairbanks Alaska Native community gathered over the weekend to welcome him home.
Friends and family danced and sang to celebrate Marvin Roberts' release from jail. Roberts, George Fries, Kevin Pease, and Eugene Vent, the men known as the Fairbanks Four, were convicted of the 1997 beating death of 15-year-old John Hartman, but their convictions have long been questioned for lack of physical evidence, and more recently because of statements by two men jailed for unrelated murders, claiming responsibility for the deadly Hartman attack. In recent years, Fairbanks Native community has driven an effort to free the Fairbanks Four, something the 37-year-old Roberts recognized in addressing the crowd at the Chief David Salmon Tribal Hall.
On behalf of George, Eugene, and Kevin, and myself and our families, it's from the bottom of our hearts, we just want to say thank you to all of you.
Roberts has been in a halfway house in Fairbanks since last week after transitioning from prisons. The other three remain in jail as a request for post-conviction relief works its way through court. Tanana Chiefs Conference President Victor Joseph reflected on the bittersweet feeling of many at the event.
As much as we're glad that Marvin's home, this fight isn't over with. It's not over with yet. Not until all the young men are home, when they are exonerated, when their hearts are free from this bad way that they've been put away.
Joseph emphasized the importance of the event as a fundraiser for the Alaska Innocence Project, which along with independent attorneys is working to exonerate the Fairbanks Four. An evidentiary hearing is scheduled for October. For National Native News, I'm Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Alaska.
An effort to build a new sustainable and energy self-sufficient community on Pine Ridge in South Dakota is underway. Tribal and federal officials attended a groundbreaking Monday. Charles Michael Ray has more.
Nick Tilson sees the groundbreaking at the Thunder Valley CDC as an historic event that signifies a tide change on Pine Ridge.
Today is the beginning of the end of poverty on Pine Ridge.
Tilson is the executive director of the Thunder Valley CDC. He spoke just before the entire crowd of community members lined up in front of a set of shovels to each take a turn at the official groundbreaking. Tilson says this project is different than housing efforts in the past, in part because it's bottom up.
This work was derived by the grassroots people here on Pine Ridge coming together to make a change and make a difference for our community.
Tilson and others involved say they found ways around the barriers that restricted tribal housing and community building in the past. He says those barriers include a lack of access to funding and extensive government red tape.
We're taking ownership over our future by creating opportunities that are grounded in what we want for our future. And so I think that over the next 3 to 5 years, you're definitely going to see a lot of building happening here, streets and water and sewer and houses and facilities, these things coming up. But I think you're also going to see this project replicated all throughout Indian country because this project is providing inspiration to people everywhere.
Tilson's work is championed by President Barack Obama. The recent federal designation of Pine Ridge as a promise zone also fast-tracks government funding for community projects like the Thunder Valley CDC. Officials with the USDA announced a grant of nearly $2 million for the project. The overall housing shortage on Pine Ridge is much bigger than this community. Economic development officials estimate the cost for infrastructure and housing needed for this tribe alone exceeds $1 billion. For National Native News, I'm Charles Michael Ray in Rapid City, South Dakota.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
Support by the Association of American Indian Physicians. Colon cancer is the second leading cause of cancer death in American Indians 50 and over. For yourself, your family, and our community, get screened. Info at AmericanIndianCancer.org.
And by the law firm of Sanosky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller & Munson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States, with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Welcome back to A Juno Afternoon. This is your hostess, Katie Bosler. And with me in the studio is David Bruce. He is here to talk about this weekend's Amateur Radio Field Day. Welcome to the program, David.
Thank you, Katie.
Well, good to have you here. Amateur radio, it sounds old school.
It is. It's been around for an awful long time that people have been interested in talking to each other for years and years, well over 100 years. And amateur radio operators have made a number of significant advances in radio over the years. The FCC licenses us. They give us call signs, and they give us certain frequencies we can operate on. They used to give us frequencies that nobody wanted. They didn't think we were any good for anything. And then when we developed them, they decided they wanted them back. So they keep giving us higher and higher frequencies to operate on, and we play all sorts of games on them and figure out how to use them effectively.
So tell me, in a nutshell, how does it work?
That's a good question. That basically you have a transmitter. You generate a signal within the transmitter, and you send it out. And you can either do what we call CW, which is code, or by voice. There's also the possibility of a lot of people get involved in using computers tied to their transmitters to send different ways. There's with the advent of some sophisticated software, there's an awful lot of it being developed, particularly related to shortwave radio and using different formats on a computer. You can make contact.
Okay.
With other people.
So do you have like a microphone or something, some kind of device you speak into that's hooked up to your whatever your apparatus is, be it a computer or?
Well, yeah. For people like me, I'm interested in making what we call DX contacts, distance contacts. And I talk into a microphone just like you've got in front of yourself.
Okay.
And with the computers, you type in your messages, and they go out, and the people send you back messages, and the computer translates it on the screen so you can read it.
Okay, so you have this field day coming up this Saturday afternoon. Tell me about that.
Actually, it starts Saturday morning at 10 a.m. and goes until Sunday morning at 10 a.m.
Oh, whoa. It's an overnight marathon.
Yes.
Okay.
And assuming the bands are open right now, I was told today that the bands are dead because there's been some explosions of the sun.
Oh,
and
my gosh.
That causes a lot of interference. We're hoping it clears up by the weekend.
Yeah, that can wreak havoc around here as well sometimes.
It certainly
yeah.
can, yes. But
solar flares, yeah.
We'll start at 10 a.m., and that's when everybody comes on, and the bands will be very silent, and then at exactly 10 o'clock, wham, everybody gets on the air. And you just try and make as many possible contacts as you can. People around there. The U.S. and Canada are divided up into districts, and we try and make a contact in every one of the districts.
Now, when you say make a contact, do you have a conversation or just to, like,
We tend to trade information. We mm-hmm. trade the station call sign. In this case, it would be KL7JRC.
Okay.
Everybody will use that, even though I have a different call sign. All the other operators have different call signs. We trade information. We usually indicate how much power we're using, anything of significance. They're mm-hmm. quick contacts because we're trying to make as many possible contacts as we can.
So is the goal to go as furthest afield as you can, to the most remote area? Is there any kind of special challenge?
It's to reach those areas that have very few operating amateurs on the air.
Mm-hmm.
And those guys are wanted to beat the band. for instance, Alaska, anywhere in Alaska is considered a foreign country, and we're really wanted. So people will come and try and contact us when we're on the air.
So this there's a mystique about contacting Alaska.
Right.
Oh, my gosh. Wow. So if a member of the public can, are they invited to join you?
Most certainly. Anyone who would like to come out, we have a picnic that starts around noon, and as long as people are interested or we have food, we'll feed anybody that comes out. We have some events and stuff. If anybody's really interested, we can get them on the air, let them talk to somebody. We'll have a flea market of ham gear. We'll have a few demonstrations of different electronic things. We have a public information booth, anybody that can come. We do invite a lot of politicians and stuff, but they very seldom ever come. They aren't particularly interested, which is their loss, because this is an interesting hobby. At least I consider it absolutely fascinating.
Yeah. Well, how long has the – now, before we get move on, just people are interested. It's taking place at the Hagavig –
Fire Training Center.
Fire Training Center.
Which is owned by the Capital City Fire Rescue, actually City of Juneau, I guess. It's out there on Sherwood Lane across from DMV. It's that big gray building that looks like a prison.
Okay, so it's roughly 10 a.m. Saturday until
10 a.m. Sunday.
Okay, so could people show up at like 2 in the morning?
They can, and we would treat them just like they showed up at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, except we won't be giving them a hamburger.
Okay. And so are people going to be taking shifts at that point?
Yes.
Of the club? Okay. So people will be bringing their sleeping bags and stuff like that, I guess.
We stay awake. And there's usually only two or three, maybe four people during the nighttime shift.
Right. Yeah,
people will be there on Saturday afternoon.
Right. Yeah. Like Juneau is so remote that you can't go home and sleep in your own bed, right? As if. Okay. Anyway, so moving on. This is really fascinating. I think in this day and age of Facebook and the internet and all that stuff, and people sitting on their laptops communicating, and this goes back, as you're saying, at least 100 years.
Right.
How long has the Juneau Amateur Radio Club been in place?
I'm pretty sure it's been around at least 40 years. I wasn't here when it was started, but I've been a member for at least 20 years. So.
And what kind of, as far as age span of people who are involved in the club, how does that work?
It's kind of interesting. We get an awful lot of people, young people, that are in school that get interested in it. Particularly, those people tend to go on and get into science, electrical engineers, electronic engineers, different things. Amateur radio gives them a chance to play around with it. They have mentors that are much older. We tend to lose the young people because they go off to college and then go off somewhere else. So the average age of our club keeps getting older and older. But almost everybody in the club started out in their teens in amateur radio. And we've got one guy that's over 90 that's been an amateur radio operator since he was a teen.
Oh, my gosh. So. Wow. And so how often do you get on the air and try to make contact?
Well, I get on probably at least every morning. I belong to the Alaska Pacific Net, which is an emergency net. If there's a disaster in Alaska, this gets brought up and it will transfer messages. One of the big things about amateur radio is the FCC wants us around, because generally if there's a big earthquake or something, we're one of the few, in the first day or two after a disaster happens, we're one of the few people that are on the air being able to transmit, because we practice setting up off the power grid, setting up in cars, on short notice any place, and we generate our own power, which we'll generate our own power field day with a generator. We won't use city electricity.
I see. So it's important just to kind of keep your chops up as far as knowing how to operate this stuff in case.
And we have some arrangements with different groups around town. We've got a station located at the Weather Bureau. They are interested in the event of a disaster that we help them with communications. Certain members of our club will automatically go to the Weather Bureau in the event of a disaster. They'll call us and we'll go. We're developing something with the hospital so they can transmit information, receive information.
So it's a real community and public service.
Yeah, that's part of the problem of radio amateur. We, the FCC reminds us that we're there to help the public. We enjoy it as a hobby.
Now, is this related by any chance to CB radio?
CB radio is kind of an unorganized group. Anybody can be a CB operator. You just go down and pay your money and you get a CB rig and you can get on the air. Amateur radio operators are licensed by the FCC. We're only licensed after we pass certain exams, different levels. And there's technician, there's general, and there's advanced extra. Advanced extra obviously has all of the privileges allowed amateur radio. General has less, and a technician is the entry level. They have lower frequencies. They're encouraged to learn and progress up through the system.
Does amateur radio have an anthem? Like, I mean, I remember when I was a kid, that was a long time ago. Remember the CB radio songs with the truckers?
Actually, we don't really. It's one of those that I don't know how to describe amateur radio operators. We're
yeah, what kind of people are you?
We're a little bit different than we're the kids in high school that wore pocket protectors for our pens. And what's interesting we're seeing is a lot of young girls are starting to get interested in amateur radio. And I think what's happening is more and more young girls are getting interested in science, and this is one avenue for them to get in to it. About a month ago, I was on the air, and I got a call from this voice that sounded like she was maybe 10 or 11 years old, and it turned out she was.
Oh my gosh.
Was at a school down in California, just a regular elementary school, that her teacher had formed a club in the school and encouraged the kids to get on the air and work towards an amateur license. And she was really fun to talk to.
Yeah. So in addition to, if you will, the nerd aspect, it sounds like it must be that kind of make your day. You don't know who you're going to meet.
Right.
That day when you get on your radio.
We all like to help kids. Generally, you can identify young voices on the air when they're calling CQ. And every amateur radio operator I know loves to talk to kids and help them and encourage them. Mm-hmm. It's just a lot of fun. And in return, they're nice. They treat us well.
So who do you have, like, a most a contact that you'll never forget that you've just seemed really unusual?
I did. It was a fellow in Cincinnati. He was a ham radio operator. He sent me a letter and said, would you take pictures of Alaska for me? He said, I was on the Aleutians in the Second World War, and he says, I've never been able to get back to see it. And he says, I want to see pictures of Alaska. So I got a bunch of rolls of film, and I went around Juneau and took a whole bunch of pictures and mailed them to him. We became very fast friends. I've never met him. But for years, we would call each other at Christmas on the telephone. We trade information back and forth. We never made contact on the radio. But for years, we kept in contact, and unfortunately, he passed away. And it was a loss, because it was just nice knowing the guy. He was friendly and just someone you'd like to have as a personal friend.
How fascinating. Think about it. Like I said, this day and age of Facebook and et cetera, a lot of it is, people you already know, but you don't know who you're going to communicate, and you can make a new friend and really help them out.
Most of the people you meet on amateur radio, you'll never see in person. You'll talk to them. You'll talk to them regularly on the air, have contact with them. You trade QSO cards. You trade information. There was a guy in Russia that, I figure he's probably getting out of jail about now, but he said, would you send me a map of Alaska? He says, I think it's fascinating. And he was up in northern Siberia where there was a nuclear power plant. And I said, well, gee whiz, I'll send him a whole bunch of maps. So I got this big box of maps, and I sent them to him. He also said he was a stamp collector, so I went to the post office and asked for all sorts of different stamps. And the people at the post office were real nice when they canceled them, because I explained what it was for. They didn't ruin them, as they sometimes do. And I sent them to him. I've never heard from him again, but it dawned on me after I sent the Oh, I worked with a guy that spoke Russian. I asked him to address it in Russian for me, and which he did, and sent it off. And it dawned on me later that, oh, my God, you know, he's probably watched pretty closely. And
okay.
They may ask him, why was he getting all these maps?
Well, who knew the life of an amateur radio operator? Wow. Both technical and social.
Mm-hmm.
Fascinating.
It's a lot of fun.
Yeah,
you just make a lot
of
good friends. Mm-hmm. They're good people in amateur radio. For instance, we very seldom ever swear on the air. There's always a few people that do something like that. But for the most part, we keep our language pretty good. We help people, and we're there if there's an emergency.
Okay, so no swearing if you come to the Hagavig Fire Center this Saturday or Sunday. Saturday through Sunday, 10 a.m. to 10 a.m. for the Amateur Radio Field Club.
Correct.
Field Club Field Day. Yes, a day that goes overnight.
Yes.
All right, anything you want to add?
Anybody would like to come, we'd sure like to have you. If you're interested in amateur radio, let us know, and we'll tell you about pending classes and what you need to do.
Okay.
Because some people do their own studying online.
Yeah, and if people want to contact the club and they're not able to come to the event this weekend, is there a website or a phone number or anything like that?
Well, we have a website. Type in Google Juno Amateur Radio Club. And if anybody is interested, they can contact me at 789-3431.
All right. David Bruce with the Juno Amateur Radio Club. Thank you so much for coming on the air this afternoon with us. It was very interesting. I learned a lot. And folks, if you want to learn more about, again, amateur radio, Hagavig Fire Center out in the valley near DMV, 10 a.m. Saturday till 10 a.m. Sunday.
Thank you, Katie.
Okay, thank you.
Come and listen in to the radio station where the mighty hosts of heaven sing. Turn your radio on.
Turn your radio on. Turn your radio on. Turn your radio on.
If you want to hear the songs of Zion coming from the land of endless spring, get in touch with God.
Get in touch with God.
Turn your radio on.
Turn your radio on.
Turn your radio on.
Turn your radio on.
And listen to the music in the air. Turn your radio on.
Turn your radio on.
Heaven's glory share. Heaven's glory share. Turn your lights down low.
Turn your lights down low.
And listen to the Master's radio. Get in touch with God.
Get in touch with God.
Turn your radio on.
Turn your radio on.
Come and listen in to the Gloryland chorus. Listen to the glad hosannas roll. Turn your radio on.
Turn your radio on.
Turn your radio on.
Turn your radio on.
Get a little taste of love eternal. Get a little heaven in your soul. Get in touch with God.
Get in touch with God.
Turn your radio on.
Turn your radio on.
Turn your radio on.
Turn your radio on.
And listen to the music in the air. Turn your radio on.
Turn your radio on.
Have the glory share. Have the glory share. Turn your lights down low.
Turn your lights down low.
Master's radio, get in touch with God.
Get in touch with God.
Turn your radio.
Radio.
Listen to the songs of the fathers and the mothers and the many friends gone on before. Radio.
Turn your radio on.
Turn your radio on.
Turn your radio on.
Some eternal morning we shall meet them over on the Hallelujah Show. Get in touch with God.
Get in touch with God.
Turn your radio.
Turn your radio.
Turn your radio on.
Turn your radio on.
And listen to the music in the air. Turn your radio on.
Turn your radio on.
Heaven's glory share. Glory share. Turn the lights down low.
Turn your lights down low.
And listen to the Master's radio.
Get in touch with God.
Get in touch with God.
Turn your radio on.
Turn your radio on.
Welcome back, everybody, to a Juno Afternoon for this Monday, or Tuesday, actually. It is the 23rd of June. This is Katie Bosler filling in for Scott Burton for a bit here this summer. And with me on the line is Flip Todd of Todd Communications. Good afternoon, Flip.
Good afternoon, Katie.
Thanks for joining us. We are having a Words 101 series, so this is part of it. And we want to talk to you about self-publishing your own book. Right?
Right.
Yeah, and you can help would-be authors, artists, photographers with that.
Right, and we have many there in Juneau, but elsewhere and all over the state.
Okay, so you've been in this business, I think, well before self-publishing became a kind of a trend, if you will. Is that accurate?
Yeah, about 35 years.
Okay. Yeah. So tell me, you know, if I wanted to publish, say, my own essay collection through you, how would I go about it?
Our company offers 4 services for people who want to self-publish, and authors or photographers, fine artists who we work with, can pick and choose among them. The first one is editing. We have people here who've been editing copy in Alaska for more than 40 years, and we help people do everything from clean up their grammar to spelling to consistency to make it read a little better. Then the second service that we offer is book design. We have a book designer on staff, and hiring a book designer is a little bit like hiring an architect to design your dream house. They have the ability to make the book attractive, physically attractive,
mm-hmm.
and they have, because of their technical knowledge of how the books are produced, there's a lot of things they can do that by virtue of the design will keep the price of printing down. For example, if you use standard page sizes, that the big parent sheets will print economically, usually multiples of 16 pages. It's quite a bit more economical per page than if you have an odd number page count, something that's not divisible by 16. Then the third service we offer is through a subsidiary called Alaska Print Brokers. We have an international print brokering business, and we try to find the printer in the world that will meet 3 criteria that are important for people, whether they're Random House, a big New York publisher, or people who are self-publishing. And those 3 criteria are quality. So for a very fine photographer like Mark Kelly in Juneau, who you all know, who we've printed books and calendars for more than 20 years, quality is a big issue as opposed to somebody printing a novel where it's just black ink on white paper. Quality is not quite so big an issue. The second factor that you're balancing is delivery date. So, for example, if you want your book back in 3 weeks, you can't print it offshore, which may be the lowest price. And then the third criteria is price. So you're balancing those 3 factors to try to get the customer what they want. Then the fourth and final service is wholesale distribution, and we sell to a little over 800 stores and institutions, organizations, museums, everybody from the big box stores like Costco and Sam's and Barnes & Noble to Ma and Pa, gift shops, tackle shops for fishing books, that kind of thing. So those are the 4 services that we offer that people may pick and choose among.
Okay, so you might just pick 1 or 2 of those. You might not do all of them.
Right,
you
can pick just 1 if you wish. You can pick all 4 if you wish. You can pick 2 if you wish, whatever you want.
Right, and I see. And then, of course, there's an hourly fee for any of these services.
Some are hourly, a professional service, like hiring an architect. The design is hourly. The editing is hourly. But the wholesale distribution is based on revenues received. So we charge a percentage of the revenues we generate. So if we never sell any of your books, we don't charge you anything. If we sell $1 million mm-hmm. worth of your books, we're going to take a really big chunk of change out of that.
Okay. And it looks like editing and book design are about $85 an hour, according to your website?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Okay. And do people ever – have you published any blogs in book form? I've always wondered about that, you know, if someone has a blog with you know, photos and or – words, have they ever come to you and say, hey, can you make a book out of this for it?
No one I can recall ever said, here's my blog, I want to publish it.
Hmm.
We did publish a book for a gentleman, a banker here in town, that was all iPhone photos that he'd taken with an iPhone. But what goes between those covers when you self-publish is entirely up to you. So we'll publish virtually, or we'll produce for them virtually anything they choose, but I don't ever remember somebody coming in and saying, here's my blog, print it.
Yeah, so, of course, we know and love Mark Kelly, who does our beautiful sunny calendars of Juneau and Southeast Alaska, and also books, and publishes through you. Are there any other Alaska?
Well, he self-publishes.
Self-publishes.
We just provide certain services for him that
right.
he
okay.
either can't or chooses not to do himself.
Yes. Okay. So are there any other Alaskan authors or photographers we might know who self-publish through Todd Communications?
Well, let's see. There's one. There's a very successful cartoonist named Chad Carpenter, and he does the Tundra cartoon strip, which is in now, I believe, more than 500 newspapers, both domestically and internationally. And we've printed books for him for close to 25 years. And he's done very well by actually retailing a lot of the books himself by having a place to sell them at the state fairs. He has a booth in a mall in Anchorage from the day after Thanksgiving until Christmas. So he's done quite well by retailing the books himself, which is difficult to do on a large scale. And then we sell the books for him to the big box stores. A lot of stores won't buy just one book from somebody. They want a supplier who will at least sell them 500 products.
So has there been an increase in people self-publishing with the assistance of Todd Communications in recent years as self-publishing seems to be becoming more of a common thing for photographers, artists, writers to do?
Yes, and not just with us, but in general, there's a lot more self-publishing going on. And much of it has to do with the fact that the book publishers have become much more conservative it's getting harder to sell books because there's so much competition from so many other forms of media. So book publishing is getting a smaller and smaller share of the total pie that people spent on entertainment and education. So because many authors cannot get published unless they're A, public figures, say they're former governor, and we've done books for former governors, but if they don't have a name that's very well recognized, which does help sell books, or have found a topic that's really of interest to a lot of people, it's hard for them to get a publisher to publish the book. So they turn to self-publishing because it's something they want done in book form, and they want the public to have access to it.
Sure. Yeah. Well, it sounds like a great resource for Alaskans as far as, you know, you being right in the state out of Anchorage for, 35 years now.
Right. And we get a fair number of customers from out of state. We've done books for customers in Washington State and California and University of New Mexico. A lot of it's just word of mouth. People see the product and ask the person who we've dealt with, who did they work with. And we're a little bit unusual in that we offer that full range. So there's a fair number of people who can do one or two of those, but very few who can do all four well.
As far as the editing, book design, book printing, and wholesale distribution?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, this is a really interesting. I'm a writer myself, and so, it's good to know about these different options available in the state of Alaska. Do you have any criteria? You know, if someone comes to you and says, "Hey, I want to publish my book," and do you ever have to say no?
I don't. Well, yeah, there's an increasing phenomenon that people go and get their book produced online with somebody like Lightning Source. And what they call printing is really what's known in the industry as print on demand, which is a fancy way of saying Xeroxing. The advantage of the print on demand is that you can do a very short run. You can do 10 books or 50 books or 100 books for less than it would cost to print conventionally with ink. That's the good news. The bad news is the cost per book is quite a bit higher than it would cost to print it conventionally with ink on paper. And we get several calls a week from people who produced a book print on demand. They may not even understand they've done it print on demand, or they may not even be familiar with the term. But that means their cost per book is so high that they cannot have it distributed through a wholesale distributor, because the costs involved with the retailer getting, in most cases, a 40% discount, and the distributor charging roughly 35 to 38% of the remaining balance, that in almost every case when a book is produced print on demand, the money they get for that book that's been distributed through the wholesale process is less than they paid Lightning Source or one of these many other print-on-demand printers to produce the book and deliver it to them. So they would lose money on every book sold. So I have to explain this several times a week to people.
Okay.
And then they usually have to make a decision. Do they want to go ahead and print it conventionally, or just decide the economics have defeated them and they drop out?
Yeah, has the ability to print conventionally, if you will, or this traditional manner with ink, is that something, a dying art, if you will? Or is that something that's alive and well?
No, it's probably the world's largest manufacturing process. Printers, you can go any place. I've spent a lot of time in Southeast Asia scouting printers. You can even go to a small town in Bangladesh and you'll find a printer.
Yay.
And you go to most towns in the United States and you'll find many printers. So printing's not dead yet.
Okay, well, this is good news. I my interview before this was with an amateur radio operator. So, you know, it's good to hear that in this day and age of exponential growth of technology, we still can have books and radio.
Right. I think radio's got a locked-in business because of drive time.
Right.
You can't watch TV while you're driving to work.
Yeah, you still got to choose to open that book. I was just looking at your website, and I noticed you have everything from an art book, the Saxman Native Village Totem Park, Alaska. Looks like a photo book. A tiny Alaskan oven cookbook. I think a lot of us know and love the Field Guide to Wild Plants of Alaska. You've got a whale's native culture, travel guides, poetry, you name it.
A lot of books that are produced in state are aimed, at least in part, if not entirely, at tourists. They're a major stimulus to the sale of books in the state. There's a lot more books sold in Alaska in the summer than in the winter.
Oh, okay. That makes sense. Yeah. Well, Flip Todd of Todd Communications here with us on a June afternoon for Words 101, part of our series. Is there anything you'd like to add about self-publishing in your operation?
Well, self-publishing is an old tradition, and the motives historically for self-publishing often had to do with, A, control of what the book looks like and the editing process. Many people have done it over the years, including Benjamin Franklin, Mark Twain, Herman Melville. Many books have been self-published, and much of the reason is control. If the author wasn't happy with what a commercial publisher did. Another reason is that it's more profitable if the book's successful. Now, if the book's not successful, the self-publisher could actually lose money if you print several thousand and it doesn't sell very many. On occasion, I think Herman Melville in particular, who was pretty poor, he did it because he couldn't find a commercial publisher who would publish his works, and he wanted to get it in print. So he had to do it himself. I think he would have been delighted if a commercial publisher said, here's a $300 advance and we'll pay 10% on every book we sell. But he couldn't. He wasn't able to do that.
Okay. So you heard that, writers, right? You could follow in the footsteps of Herman Melville and publish your own book right here in the state of
Alaska. Or Ben Franklin or Mark Twain.
Yeah, those guys.
Right.
All right. Well, Flip, thanks so much for joining us today on a June afternoon. If people want to get in touch with you or Todd Communications to their questions about self-publishing, where would they go?
Oh, they can call our main number, 929-5500, and they can ask for me, or they can go to our website. They can send us an email. They can send me an email if they want. flip@todcom.com, flip@todcom.com. We kind of pride ourselves on personal service and dealing directly one-on-one and not putting them through the website maze that so many of us kind of bristle at a little bit. So we try, even if the news is going to be bad news, like there's your book is upside down. In other words, you've paid so much for the books you're asking us to distribute it that you'll lose money on every book. We try to give people the facts of life and explain the economics as well as the other parts of producing a book.
Okay, folks, but if you do want to call Flip Todd at Todd Communications, you can always Google Todd Communications, and the phone number is right there.
Right.
And the address. And the facts. Thank you so much, Flip, for joining us today. That was very informative.
You're most welcome.
All right, take care.
Okay, bye-bye.
Paperback,
him on the air. You've heard him online. Now you can have him whenever and wherever you want him.
I'm Matt Miller with a look at today's headlines.
Yes, it's the greatest hits of Matt Miller.
Today's forecast promises rain in the capital city.
The greatest hits of Matt Miller, not available in any store.
The airport reports that all planes are running on schedule.
The greatest hits of Matt Miller. Tune in to Morning Edition, weekday mornings on KTOO News.
Welcome back to A Juno Afternoon, everybody. This is Katie Bosler, and I'm filling in for a bit this summer for Scott Burton. With me in the studio is Miles Gayton, who is from the class of 2015 at the University of Alaska Southeast. Good to have you here, Miles.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So Miles, some of you might have heard our radio spot, had, I think, a really kind of unique UAS journey where most people, correct me if I'm wrong, don't say, I think I'm going to go to UAS to learn to speak fluent Spanish.
Yeah, I don't think, maybe that's not the common route for most people. It just kind of worked out that way for me, too. I don't think I looked into it like that either.
Yeah, so tell us a bit about your college journey.
I started going to school at UAS really just because I wanted to get back home. I was in Hawaii for my first semester, and I just found that climate-wise and kind of where I wasn't really ready to be so far away from home and such a drastically different climate. I identify myself as a skier, so there wasn't really much opportunity for that. But you know, all things said and done, I came back home and just started taking classes at UAS because it was an economic option. And I realized, you know, I didn't necessarily want to bus tables or be a waiter for years and years to come. And so I decided to keep going to school and just kind of got lucky in that opportunities kept on presenting themselves with Spanish and then with the outdoor studies program. And I kind of fell into a rhythm, and the next thing I know, I was fluent in Spanish, I guess you kind of say.
Okay, but that of course, that took place in different phases over a number of years.
Yeah. Yeah, it took me 8 years with a couple semesters off to get through my undergrad. A lot of indecision, but also just a lot of interest in classes based on, you know, the criteria. I wasn't your typical four-year student by any means.
So did you have a major picked out or something you'd chosen?
After about 4 years, I picked my major. I am very, very fortunate enough to have had a tuition waiver. My mom works at the university, and so I've used that to help myself during the process of figuring out what it was that I was going for.
So what was your major, ultimately?
My major in the end was a liberal arts degree, and they have a few different options. I chose the independent design option and kind of combined Spanish, environmental studies, and outdoor leadership to sculpt my, I don't know, my interests.
And so these were classes that you had the main emphasis in as these three areas. So tell us a little bit about the Spanish. This involved a quite a bit of study abroad.
Yeah, so there was a point where I decided that kind of based on where I was with my Spanish and where I wanted to be as far as fluency, that a study abroad was the logical option. And so I started looking around, and it turned out that the university had gotten approval to take a group of students to Cuba at the same time that I was looking to go somewhere. And so I jumped on board with that.
That was in 2000, that was a few years ago.
2012.
12, okay.
Yep. Yeah. So myself and 11 other students went down to Cuba for 2 months. Four professors kind of rotated through, each teaching a different course. And
right.
We really, the goal was to, you know, familiarize ourselves with Cuba and its culture as it was going through a very, you know, notable transition as far as economy and politics.
Yes, the spring of 2012. So you had like a Hemingway phase. You had a sort of kind of tourism, seeing what they were doing with ecotourism, that kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. So the tourism class was kind of a compare and contrast between Cuba and Juneau. We had a class focused on Ernest Hemingway's literature as he spent a third of his life just outside of Havana in that area. And then we had an anthropology course, which was more independent as far as what the student decided to research, as well as in the very beginning, we spent 2 weeks focusing on Spanish to transition into being able to communicate a little more with locals.
So tell me about your Spanish background before you went to Cuba.
So when I was really young, my mom spoke Spanish to me and my brother. She had learned as a young adult. And so I was exposed to the language as a young kid. And then in middle school, I had the option to choose between studying Spanish and French. And Spanish was, you know, it made sense. I had already learned a little bit of the language as far as colors and numbers and some basics. So I went with that. And I continued studying Spanish all through high school. And when I got back to, you know, Juneau and started taking classes at UAS, I decided to take some classes to get back into a rhythm, as I'd had kind of a couple-year hiatus. And I just kept going with it. I was interested. And Rick Bellog is a guy who was teaching some classes, conversation courses in Latin American literature, and a really great instructor that sparked my interest more. And so,
yeah. So you went to Cuba, and then you had another academic exchange.
So I went to Cuba, and then I also actually had the opportunity to go to Ecuador in the winter of 2012,
yeah.
2013, December, January, to go on a high-elevation mountaineering trip.
With outdoor studies.
With outdoor studies. And so a group of 10 students, I believe there was, we went down to Quito and spent a month in the surrounding area and climbed two different mountains, Cotopaxi and Cayambe. These are all, both of these are, you know, volcanoes in the Andes mountain range that snow line lies at about 15,000 feet. And so we spent time down there acclimatizing and focused a little bit on culture, but more so on, you know, the mm-hmm. goals of summiting these mountains. So that was, you know, a very unique opportunity.
That sounds pretty incredible.
Yeah, and it ended up being that my Spanish worked out great for logistics as far as getting around while we were there.
Oh, so you're sort of the translator for the group.
Yeah, which wasn't my plan, but it just turned out that it, you know, worked out that way, and it worked out pretty good.
So you felt like that helped to build your skill sets? You're not only got some outdoor studies, mountaineering skills, but also Spanish skills unexpectedly through this?
Right, exactly. And then in 2013, I got to go to Argentina on an international study abroad. So I spent a semester down in Mendoza and just, you know, had a homestay experience. So I lived with a family for 4 months. And went to a local university there, took classes in Spanish, and made friends and just had a great time. My degree, you know, is in outdoor studies, outdoor leadership, environmental studies, all these things. But when I was there, they didn't really have classes in those kinds of fields, so I ended up taking communications courses, and ironically, I took a radio workshop class.
Well,
so
we're coming full circle,
here
on a Juno afternoon today. We started out with an amateur radio operator.
And we got another one,
that's
maybe.
Right.
I don't know.
Yeah. So now I guess you'll be starting a Spanish language program here in Juneau.
I don't have any, you know, solid plans. Uh-huh. I do like the idea of continuing with Spanish, maybe getting a certificate to teach English abroad so that I can travel to more Spanish-speaking countries or ones I've been to prior and mm-hmm. teach English. I also see myself at some point down the road doing a MAT, Master's of Arts in Teaching. Maybe
for
UAS.
UAS.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
actually, that was the thought, to be able to teach Spanish. And in the meantime, I've been doing work with a local company, Above and Beyond Alaska, doing day trips and overnight trips, kayaking and hiking on the glacier. And
have you had any Spanish-speaking clients?
On occasion. It's not all that often, but I have had clients that speak Spanish, whether it's as their first language or you know, that they're second generation and their parents speak it with them. But it's been a nice bonus when I get to use my Spanish on trips, for sure.
Well, I hear to get a job in California these days, Spanish is a real plus.
Yeah. I was on a road trip in the fall, and I found that there was a lot of areas that I passed through where you would hear Spanish. So I'm really finding that it...
It's a huge part of the especially lower 48 population, but from what I can tell, more and more Spanish-speaking people are coming up here.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. I had a lot of coworkers actually in the past that I worked with that were Spanish speakers, and great opportunity to practice before I had done any immersion. Kind of, mm-hmm. you know, it was a little bit of a suffer fest. I just kind of, you know, fish for words and then slowly add them to my vocabulary.
Yeah, what was the process like of becoming fluent? Was there like a sort of transitional moment there? Or?
There was definitely transitional moments, I would say multiple, kind of these barriers that you break through over time. And I think a lot of that was related to, you know, not having the right vocabulary and then slowly accumulating that and being able to form the ideas into words that you know, may have in English in the back of your head but not know how to bring out Spanish. So I definitely saw myself, and then transitioning, you know, trip to Argentina, conversation separate to the day. So we're driving in Spanish.
There you go. Keep up your skills that way.
I have no shame in that.
So it keeps your brain and your life interesting. What's it like to be bilingual?
I don't know. It's the only life I really know, I guess.
Yeah.
But it's nice.
And students or people, you know, who are considering UAS, what would you say to them about the options there?
I think it is a great option to consider. My first university experience was in lecture halls where you're one of 300 students in a crowd, and transitioning back from that to UAS, I became a name and not just a face, and developed, you know, relationships with my professors and, you know, student to teacher ratio, having a, you know, less people in the classroom gives you more attention and more opportunity to really make strides and progress. And UAS, you know, offered me opportunities that I don't really feel like I'd have otherwise. The outdoor studies program opened doors as far as backcountry adventures that I wasn't really, you know, even aware of prior, like ice climbing and swift water rescue, wilderness first responder certification, even just backcountry skiing. You know, Eagle Crest is this haven near home.
Yes.
And to be able to get out, you know, past the boundary line and still have skills to do that safely.
Well, it sounds like you made the most of your University of Alaska Southeast experience.
I would say so.
Well, Miles Gayton, who just graduated class 2015, thank you so much for sharing your UAS journey with us and learning Spanish, and all the best to you in the future.
Thank you very much.
Take a look at the weather here. It looks like it is just balmy and beautiful out there with clear skies and just not much wind from the southwest to 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow, more clouds with a slight chance of rain and still high temperatures, close to 70 degrees. Cloudy chance of rain through tomorrow night and just rain in the forecast, plain rain. I think the gardens and plants and flowers will like it. Plain rain in the forecast for Thursday, Friday, and then more partly cloudy skies in the forecast for the weekend with the lows in the around 53 and the highs in the mid-60s. Tomorrow on a Juno afternoon, it looks like we'll continue our Words 101 series with poets Emily Wall and Christy Name Erickson. Tim Ortiz and Adriana Donahue will be here with an update on art classes at the Canvas. We'll learn about a Tai Chi series for seniors and talk with Assistant Fire Chief Ed Kinto about Summer Fire Station. That is tomorrow at 3 o'clock right here on KTOO 104.3. If you missed the live show every day, also available at 4 on KRNN.
This is KTOO Juno. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juno and Douglas. We also rebroadcast on Translators K276.